That was scholar and activist Ward Churchill speaking last January at the National Conference on Organized Resistance. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. In our next hour, the fight to improve the conditions of working people from the factories of China to the farms of Oregon.
We have fed you all for 1,000 years. You hail us still unfed. But there's never a dollar of all your wealth but marks the workers dead. We have given our best for to give you rest while you lie on your crimson wall. If blood be the price of all your wealth, good God, we have paid in full. There's never a mine blows skyward now. We're buried alive for you. There's never a wreck drift shoreward now, but we are its ghastly crew. And you can reckon our dead by the forges red, for the factories where we spin. And if blood be the price of all your wealth, good God, we have paid it in. We have fed you all for 1,000 years. That was our doom, you know, from the days when you chained us in your fields to the strike a week ago. You have taken our lives and our jobs and our pride and called it your legal share. But if blood be the price of your lawful wealth, good God, we have bought it fair.
This is Chris Sturr. On February 22nd, Alice Kwan of the Hong Kong Christian Industrial Committee spoke at Harvard University about the sweatshop conditions in factories producing toys and apparel for Disney in the industrial zones of southern mainland China. The talk was sponsored by Harvard Students Against Sweatshops. Because of restrictions on activities by non-governmental organizations and independent labor unions, the research conducted by Kwan's organization has had to be clandestine. But interviewing workers secretly outside of factory walls is likely to yield more accurate information about factory conditions than that obtained by industry-sponsored monitoring organizations like PricewaterhouseCooper, the firm that has been retained by Harvard to monitor the factories where Harvard sweatshirts and caps are made. Harvard Students Against Sweatshops is pushing the university to join the Workers' Rights Consortium, which is committed to independent monitoring of factories. Over 60 universities in the U.S. have joined the Workers' Rights Consortium under pressure from chapters of United Students Against Sweatshops. Alice Kwan was introduced by Jeff Ballinger, a longtime anti-sweatshop activist and founder of the human rights group Press for Change.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and I'd just like to say, if you hand me, Jonah, that book. By the way, I'd like to introduce a celebrity of sorts here, cyber celebrity Jonah Peretti from MIT. You've probably seen the email. He tried to order a pair of Nike ID sneakers with the word sweatshop written on it and created this storm of controversy. I've seen dozens of emails to my box telling me I have to read this funny story. And now it's been in Time magazine, and The Independent in London wrote a big editorial about it the other day, and I think it's a culture jammer's action of the year. Maybe not the new century. So Jonah, thanks for coming out, and thanks to all of you here. I just want to take a second to show you what Nike sent out today, 106 pages of pretty incriminating stuff about its factories in Indonesia. They've gotten into a partnership with the Global Alliance, which is some organization set up to go out and sort of monitor Nike factories. And actually, it's a public relations operation. And what's surprising about the Indonesia study is that it's actually very damning about what goes on in Indonesian factories. Lots of physical and verbal abuse, some sexual harassment, and it's pretty remarkable that that all this is out there in a study sent out by Nike. I think they knew, because we've got such awesome archives of this Nike and Indonesia situation, that they couldn't do, you know, they couldn't just pass off a report that didn't really delve into the issue. So I encourage you to get a look at that at some point. And it's really a pleasure for me to be here and introduce a good friend of mine, Alice Kwan, who works at the Hong Kong Christian Industrial Committee. And really, without people like Alice going out there and doing the spade work and getting the information about what goes on in these factories around the world and in very difficult places to operate like China, we would be at a loss, we anti-sweat activists, because you know, we wouldn't know what goes on in those factories. The toys that you buy for your nieces and nephews, the sneakers, the sweatshirts, and all the stuff that's produced increasingly in Asia. You know, Alice's group gets out information about health and safety issues, about you know, workers who try to change things, and terrible things happen to them, as you know. So I'll let Alice tell you all about her work and just try to give you my two cents here to encourage you to step up your pressure to get Harvard to join the Workers' Rights Consortium. It's so important that we now have, you know, maybe 60, 70 universities and colleges banded together to put some real eyes and ears out there in the developing world, partnering with groups like Alice's group, and get some real information about these factories, which the students were successful in forcing these companies to disclose where the factories are. Now we've got to get people out there to talk to these workers, as they've done down in Mexico with the Kukdong workers. And we know how effective that is, and you just got to step up the pressure so we can get one or two more colleges in the Boston area into the Workers' Rights Consortium. So with no more ado, I'd like to introduce Alice Kwan from the Hong Kong Christian Industrial Committee. Thank you.
So, good evening. So glad to be here. So I think it is good for me to be here that to share more about the workings and living conditions of Chinese workers. So because my organization's Hong Kong Christian Industrial Committee, it is a local-based local labor non-governmental organizations in Hong Kong. So, but most of our work in mainland China, especially we conduct us quite big numbers of research on the working and living conditions in mainland China. Our main focus are those factories who produce for the big brand names like Nike, Reebok, Adidas, Disney, Gap, Jansport, and so on and so forth. So what I can share is mainly is about the workings and living conditions over there. So my main work is when is go to mainland China to go to the industrial zone, especially in the special economic zones. I will be there to interview workers. I try to contact them, have interview with them. Although we are not allowed to go inside the factories, but we are allowed to be just outside the factories and interview the workers when they are off duties. So what we got is mainly directly from workers, but not from the management, but not from the officials factory with it. So what we have done is, as I mentioned, is the research. So I'm going to show you, this is our latest report. The report's called Beware of Mickey. So this is a report that we made. This is the evil Mickeys. So we are trying to locate 12 Disney suppliers in South China. And all what we find is all the working conditions and living conditions are totally disgusting. They not only violate Disney's code of conduct, but also violate Chinese labor law. So I'm going to describe what happens in the factories. So mainly, when we talk about scrap shops, so we have some criteria, and then these working conditions will consider scrap shops. So first of all, of course, is about the wages. So when we're talking about the wages in China, especially for these Disney's workers over there, mainly their wages, the monthly wages is about 60 to 85 US a month. So it includes everything, all the food, dormitory allowance, overtime bonus, all calculate is 60 to 85 US a month. But for those unskilled toy workers, they get less. For example, it's about 37 to 60 US a month. So, but the most important thing is these wages are not sufficient for them to sustain a decent life or even a basic, it is not enough for their basic livings in the South China. So yes, we always say that in China we have very progressive labor law. For example, when we're talking about the wages, there is a minimum wage law. But what we find is the minimum wage level now in South China cannot afford someone to live basically, enough to sustain a basic life in South China because the price keep raising and raising. So it is the most important. And when we check with the workers, yes, maybe they get 60 to 85 US a month, which is slightly higher than the minimum wage level. But what is the truth is they are still underpaid. Why? Because the minimum wage, how they calculate, is based on 40 hours a week. And 40 hours a week. But, you know, most of the Chinese workers, they work is 12 to 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it is, and that's why I will conclude that all of them are being underpaid. So they are not only paid, their pay is really very teeny, but also most of the workers, they get the delayed payment because most of the employers, they will withhold 1 month to 2 month wages as the deposit. And most of the workers, they cannot get the refunds. Even when they quit their jobs, they will not be refunded all the withheld wages. And also because the factory tried to withhold these wages, many workers they suffer is the financial difficulties. So for the long working hour, I have just mentioned most of them have to work 12 to 17 hours a week, a day. So, but you know, in the peak season, when there are thousands orders to do, they have to meet the deadline for the Christmas. Most of them have to work overnight. Maybe they have to work overnight, and in the next day, they have to work as usual. it is really very common for them to work 7 days a week, week by week, or maybe for a month they have no single day off. So this is the point. Because for the consumer in the north, they always wonder why these Chinese workers, they can stand these so disgusting working conditions. Why don't they just refuse to work overtime? So I'm going to tell you the truth is, first, because they are not allowed to refuse to work overtime. The second is because their wages are so teeny, so the no wages urge them to work non-stop, day by day, weeks by weeks, month by month. And based on our calculations, some of workers, their hourly wages is just 60 cents an hour. So I think it is really very unreasonable. So other than the low wages, delayed payment, long working hours, the other situation is about the fines and penalty system. You know, it is really very common in the Chinese factories, so they will have the fine system. So when we talk about whether the factory will have the code of conduct, the workers will confuse what is code of conduct. Or are you talking about the factory's regulations? Because to them, the factory regulations are more related to their life rather than the code of conduct. Why? Because the fine system. So for example, I'm going to cite some example. If the workers wear the jeans to go to the workplace, they will be fined for $6. When they forget to switch off the electricity, they will be fined another $6. When they want to leave their seats to go to toilets or to go to drink waters, but without get the permissions from the management, they will be fined again. So you can see there are so many unreasonable high fines to them, and it's really flat their livings. But I have to emphasize all these fines are illegal. And even some workers just tease to us that some of their boss get rich because of their fines. The other I would like to talk about the food and the dormitories. So it is quite different from the situation in Indonesia or in Thailand or in the Central America. Because most of the workers, what I mentioned, they are the migrant workers. They work in South China, but most of their mother tongue are in the North China. So they will live from their home and then rush to the south. So actually they cannot, because it is 1,000 miles away, so they have to live and eat in the south just away from their family. So most of these factories, they will arrange dormitories, they will arrange canteens in the factories to offer the workers to have place to eat and live. But yeah, for sure, it's cost money. I'm not saying it's absolutely free of charge. Most of the employers, they will deduct the fees automatically from their wages. So, but what I would like to emphasize is the qualities of the dorms and food are totally odd, awful. So, some workers describe the food are at worst as pig feet. Can you imagine? As worse as pig feet. And some of the workers, they are arranged to live in the chibo desk bag. Can you imagine? Only the story that we find maybe in the Second World War, maybe people will live in the chibo desk bag. But this is in the Chinese factories. So the other case is 400 workers are arranged to live in a big dorm rooms. So they have no privacy. And also, there is only 3 exits in the room, and all windows are barred. So can you imagine when there is a fire, how this worker gets escaped from the fire? I don't know how many of you knew the news 7 years ago. In 1993, November, there is a big fire in China. The fires happened in a toys factory in South China. In the fire, there were 87 women workers died, 47 workers injured. Why there are so many people died? Because all the windows are locked, all the gates are locked. Because the employers, they were so worried the workers will just be lazy and will just go out the factories to have fun when they work. So they knock all the doors, all the windows. But it still happens in Chinese factories. The factories have more power or more controls over the workers because you have no excuse to refuse to work overtime because your dorm just next to the factories. And all your team workers, they work overtime. How come you refuse to work overtime? And also there are, I think, in this practice, it's caused a series of problems. For example, there is no couples dorms. So even, for example, a couples work in the same factories, but they have to live apart. If you would like to rent a room outside, yes, you can. So I share the other case to you is a couple, they work in the same industrial zone, but because they are not in the same factories and also there is no couples dorms in their factory, so they have to live chance. Then they rent a room outside. Here is what she said. To save money, so we shared to rent a room with 3 couples. And she said that it is very embarrassing. The so-called privacy is just covered under the curtain hand on the edge of beds. So you can imagine. And also most of the workers, they will under this dorm practice. They have no social life because what's their friends may be just their roommates, but it's difficult for them to make friends in the same industrial zone. I did not mention much, but most of these workers I have just mentioned, most of them are the single young single women. Migrant women workers, because they also have no times and they have no space to develop not only the romantic relationship but even they have no social life. And also I just some of my US friend just reminds me, because to me it is really very usual, but to you maybe it is really odd. In most of the Chinese factories, so they like a very big campus, but they are not the nice campus like the Harvard. So most of the campus is just under the big wall and then have the friends over the wall. And just like the prisons, and in the gates, there are 1 or 2 security guards over there. So when there is off duty, there will someone to stand over there to knock whether you steal anything from them, and you have to show your pass. Otherwise, you cannot get inside the factories. So it is really, really very inhuman to a certain extent. Just in short is, for example, when we're talking about the social security, But I can say that according to the law, all the employers have to buy the social insurance for the workers. But no, most of them just ignore the law. So what will happen? When this worker get retired, they will get no pensions. When they get injured, they will get, it is really very difficult for them to get the compensation. But I can cite some figures to you is in Shenzhen. Shenzhen is somewhere just next to the Hong Kong. It is also the South China. So in Shenzhen, every day there are 31 arms are being cut because of the occupational accidents. Every day, just in the single place, Shenzhen, 31 arms are cut. So can you imagine how terrible situations over there? And there is no trade unions. I have to clarify, there is only one trade unions in China. It is the party controls trade unions. All China federations of trade unions. And workers are not allowed to organize themselves. They have no rights of organizing. They have no rights to have freedoms. They have no collective bargaining power. So this is really very important. So when we check with the TNC, there are more and more companies, they have their code of conduct, but not many companies' code of conduct mentions about the rights of organizing or freedoms of associations. So it is really very interesting. So when we check with some company, they have the rights of organizing in their code of conduct, but we ask, so how you operates it in China, they will say that, sorry, it is not my fault. I would like to comply what my code of conduct promise, but it is not my fault. It is the Chinese government's problem. I would like to do so, but because it is not allowed to go, it is not allowed to do it in China. So don't bring us. And then they wash their hands. It is not their responsibilities. But is it the case? So for us, what we would like to demand, or what we think the student hears, or the consumers, mainly the student, what they can do here is there are four faults you can do. One is student to student. So when you learned about the working conditions or living conditions, about the developing countries, about the all about the stories of workers who produce for your college, who produce for the big company. So what you can do is the student to student talk. So please share this story to the others, so more and more people alert the problems. Second is student to consumer. So actually student are the consumer as well. But what you can do is try to also to share these information to the consumer and call them and work with you to collect your power, your pressures, to give pressures to the companies, to ask them to fix the problem. Because I want to emphasize is to fix the problem, but not one away. Because what we find in the situation is, in the past, there are many companies, when they find there is a scrap shop case in Asia or in the Central America, what they do is, okay, so these factories does not comply with our code of conduct. Okay, yes, I got your ideas, and I cut the order, I terminate the order, and I run away. So we call it cut and run. But it is really, really irresponsible practice. Because to the TNCs, cutting is never the big problem. Because, you know, now there are thousands of hands waving to the TNC say, "Ah, I would like to have the business relationship with you." So they can maybe they can get a more best price. They have a better have a best offer from the new partners. So it is to them it is not a big problem, but to the workers it is a big problem, because most of these TNC they just cut and run away, run from their responsibilities. So the workers they will suffer more. What we find in this story, because this is not the first Disney report, this is the second one. But when we try to follow up the factory that we investigate in the first report, we find no ways. Because all the factories we report in the first report, Disney has cut all the orders. And we find no ways to compare whether the situation improved or not, because they cut and won. So, and what we find in this report is most of the workers, I mean those factories being cut order, the workers were left awake and the situation get worse. For example, most of them, they get less than the minimum wage. They get insufficient work to do, and most of them, they have to quit the job and find another job. So here, what we demand is, please come up with us to stand up and press the TNC to fix the problem. Not just focus whether the factories comply or not comply. When you decide whether you keep to have the business relationship with the factories, please consider the interests of workers. If you really committed to respect the workers' right, please work it out. Don't just pay the lip service. Fix the problem, but not cut and run. So the third you can do is the student to TNC. So student to TNC, as what I just mentioned, just press them to fix the problem, to not to run away, and to really to put it into practice, to bear the social responsibilities. So the fourth things you can do is student to workers. So what you can do to the workers, because you are maybe you say, I'm in the US, but how I can show my solidarity support to the Chinese workers? Yes, you could do it. Is try to press all the parties you can pressure to fix the problem. And it is the best way for you to show your solidarity support to them. Here, it is the Disney report. I don't know how many of you would like to have a look. If you would like, you can just inform me. And here, what we can find, we've asked Disney workers to write an open letter to Disney. So what you can do, the direct support to these workers, is please use this letter. Hear what's their demands. Hear what's their situations, and ask Disney to fix the problem. So for us, we will never call boycott. It is not a boycott campaign. I don't know, maybe it is the same case for the USAX, but for my organization, we seldom call boycott, because unless we get the permissions or we are endorsed by the workers, we find no one have the right to call boycott, because what we have to concern is the interests of workers. So boycott cannot solve the problem. So I don't know whether I mispresent. I'm not saying these people prefer to work in the sweatshops just because they have no chance, they have no alternative, so they have to work over there. And because they don't know their rights, so they have to work there. So that's why we ask to have the workers' rights education inside the factories. And also, the second very important points. Why they have to work in the scrap shops? Why they don't voice out their discontents? Because up to now, most of the factories, they did not have this kind of complaint system. No one dare to talk the truth to anybody, because even, you know, most of the company, I'm not only saying Disney, but you know Nike, you know the other brand names, and you saw there are so many so-called you have read many articles to blame the social auditing firm. Because most of this monitoring, if they conduct by the social auditing firm or they conduct by the company compliance teams, the situation is the workers will never disclose any truth to these people, because the workers are never guaranteed that they will not be penalized after they doing so. What I can share is now there are so many ridiculous cases in the monitoring process. So now there is no, all the report claim, oh, we are independent, we are the very honorable Pricewaterhouse, SGS, Veritas. So don't trust it. Because what we find from the workers, they will say, no way, hey, don't be silly, don't believe those reports, because most of those reports are conducted by the alarmed wizard. That means the factory will be ring up few weeks ago and say, hey, factory A's, we are from the PwC and we are going to investigate your factory 3 weeks later what time, and you know what will happen. The factory will just clean up everything before the audit, before the monitoring come, and even some very ridiculous cases, the workers are forced to sign many thick work records, sign the thick payroll, and they are wanted to overstate their wages and underreport their working hours. And even in one or two factories, there is a script. The script is the management prepare script. So it teach you how to answer the questions to the monitors. So you can see that you find no ways to get the truth from so these kinds of social monitoring teams. And to us, we find that even we cannot replace, we are not the truly independent monitors. Who should be the true independent monitors? Are the workers themselves. Because they are the one who work daily in the factories. They know all the working conditions. They know the chemicals. The wages, how their wages to calculate. So no one should replace their votes to be the true monitors. And also we always say that the Pricewaterhouse, they are the independent trade union, they are the independent social monitoring teams. So we should ask how independent they are, who pay them. They earn a huge amount of money. Yes, and also how frequent they will be in the factories. Maybe six months. So we think workers should be the final true independent monitors. Yes. And just I would like to conclude my speech by using some works from a workers. It is directly from the workers. It is about his view on code of conduct. Here it says, Disney is only concerned with its good reputations. When its suppliers are revealed not to comply with the local standard and its law. They will mostly cut their orders and move the productions to another facilities. What Disney did is to walk away from the scandal and draw a line between the problematic facilities and Disney. They wash their hands as if it is none of their business. The code of conduct is not made for workers. It is only a tactic of window dressing and PR for Disney. So this is directly from the workers. So, and this is all what I would like to share. That's all. Thanks.
That was Alice Kwan of the Hong Kong Christian Industrial Committee speaking at Harvard University last month. Farm workers in Oregon have taken their fight for a union on the road to ask the public to help them put pressure on an agribusiness giant that is fighting their attempts to unionize.
Hi, this is Wayne Heimbach for Labor Express. One of the issues that we've talked about a lot on this show is the exploitation of working people. People who work hard often get hurt at their jobs, and when they try to organize, sometimes have a difficult time doing that. One of the main groups in this society, in this country, in this economy that has been exploited and hurt on the job and has had a very difficult time organizing is farm workers. And what we're going to be talking about today is a union in Oregon has been working on this issue for quite a long time, has had some successes, and is looking to people around the country to help it continue with the organizing it's been doing of farm workers in Oregon. And we're talking with Ramon Ramirez, who's president of PCUN, which is the Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United. And PCUN obviously is not the initials, it's from the Spanish. And Ramon, what is the name of the organization?
The name of the organization is Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, which is PCUN, and also in the English it would translate to Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United.
Right, good. And welcome to Labor Express. Before we get into talking, though, I want to read a paragraph from your website, actually. It talks about your organization. PCUN is Oregon's Union of Farm Workers, Nursery, and Reforestation Workers, Oregon's largest Latino organization. Our fundamental goal is to empower farm workers to understand and take action against systematic exploitation and all of its effects. In 1985, 80 farm workers and tree planters founded PCUN. Since that time, we have registered more than 4,500 members, 98% of which are Mexican or Central American immigrants, with about half residing permanently in Oregon. So that's quite an accomplishment since 1985. And not only are you a union, but as your statement says, you're also Oregon's largest Latino organization. I'm sure you must be very proud of that.
Yeah, and it is. It's been a major accomplishment. We formed a union back in 1985, and have developed into a union that now, after basically 16 years of struggle, have secured the first collective bargaining agreements in Oregon history. And we did that. We did this at a time when it was really difficult to organize. We started organizing back when the Air Controllers Union was, PAPCO was busted by then President Reagan, and the labor movement was at an all-time low, and we were organizing immigrants. The saying that, organized the unorganized, we were organizing the never organized. Mm-hmm. And so it was an uphill battle, and, we proved, in the end that, with a good strategy and old-fashioned organizing, taking a page from the labor history movement, that a community labor organization can survive in these times, and also develop into an effective union that brings a voice for farm workers in the workplace, and that's what we've been able to do.
One of the things that you said that I think is very important, and looking through your literature, I think it stands out, that you are a trade union and you deal with workers and worker issues, but you look at people more than just as people who work in the fields, but they have a full life. And your organization has many things that relate to their lives, from safety to women's issues to learning English, a whole range of things. So you see yourselves as a union. but you also see yourselves as dealing with Latino community in Oregon. Is that something that developed immediately or over a period of time?
It developed over time, but I think our vision was that looking at the work that the great leader Cesar Chavez had done back in organizing farm workers in the 50s and 60s, is that you really need to develop a movement. Mm-hmm. It's not about developing a straight up and down labor union. You have to develop a union, especially when you're working with a sector of the working class that traditionally has not had a voice in the workplace, that traditionally has looked at unions in a very negative way in their home countries like Mexico, El Salvador, and other places where we have members. And so we had to do a large amount of education and re-education, but also build a movement around, our primary goal. Our primary goal, and I think the primary goal of any labor union in this country, is not only to secure collective bargaining agreements for their membership and bringing about better working and living conditions for workers, but also sustaining that, right? And in the farm worker movement, the farm workers since 1935, when the New Deal was passed, have been excluded from the National Labor Relations Act and on all the benefits and protections that workers have, to secure a collective bargaining agreement. So for farm workers, the only leverage that we have is through strikes and through boycotts, and to do that, to sustain a boycott and to organize, you really need the broader community support, not only being there, but financially, having people contribute to the cause, volunteering, and it's not enough in our movement, in the farm worker struggle, that people say, I support the farm worker cause, but they really got to defend it in a big way, and they really got to be there when farm workers are most at need. So we that was our goal. So the other thing, the other aspect to our work is really building the kind of leadership is necessary to sustain this kind of movement, and that means really rolling up our sleeves and working at educating and creating a spirit of struggle with workers, many who are immigrants, and in that process, we're asking workers to fight the ultimate fight. We're asking workers to sacrifice the lowest paid workers in this country, the hardest working workers in this country, the workers that put the food on the American table, and for that matter, the food on in the whole world, that we're asking them to go on strike. That's the ultimate sacrifice. So, in order for us to do that, it takes a lot of education. And, in our structure in the union, like you said, we do have a worker center where we provide services to workers, much needed services like immigration, workman's comp, wage claims. We teach farm workers, to speak English and learn English. And also those who are permanent residents, the need to become U.S. citizens, right? And so, to a lot of ways, we're talking about building the political power, right? And using that clout that traditionally immigrants have not had in this country, to use it in a positive way to build the power necessary to win contracts. So it's not the road to collective bargaining for farm workers is not, you sign authorization cards, you get your election certified by the National Labor Relations Board, and you have an election, and then if you win, you can negotiate a contract with your employer. We don't have that legal mechanism for farm workers. So it's through raw power, right? That we're gonna get collective bargaining. It's like economic pressure, because a lot of these folks that run farms, I don't want to say that all the farmers are like that, because we do have at this point we have three farmers under collective bargaining agreements, but it's been hard. They feel they have this special privilege, and they don't want to negotiate with their workers. And that it breaks down to two points, basically: racism and power. power that they've maintained for hundreds and hundreds of years. And when you look at that special privilege that growers say that they have, you know, a lot of that really stems from the fact that when the New Deal got negotiated back in the 1930s, right, a lot of that special privilege came from the fact that their representatives on the table were the Dixiecrats. And if you look deeper in analysis of where that privilege comes from, it comes straight from Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. And it's no coincidence that the farm workers in the 1930s were not Latinos and they were African Americans, and that's why they were excluded from the New Deal. That's why farm workers, especially African American farm workers, were excluded from any collective bargaining agreements or protections.
And I know from looking at the history of it, a lot of the farm worker organizing in the 1930s had to be the kind of movement, kind of organizing that you're doing now, because it was very difficult and there were a lot of things that they had to work against. Your organization being not just a union but also sort of a community-based organization has also led you to talk to your members and to the public about one of the big issues of our time right now, which is immigration reform. And before we go into some of the more specific stuff on the on your union and an upcoming action that you're asking people to participate in, could you explain to us what have you done in Oregon to try to pull together some kind of a coalition to work on this this fight around immigration reform?
Well, one of the things that happened in Oregon was really interesting is that right after the 187 got passed in California, Proposition 187, That proposition was then introduced in the state of Oregon. And what they did is they did it in a way that would they introduced four separate pieces of bills or measures that would really go farther than 187. And we were able to put a really effective immigrant rights coalition that created some outstanding alliances, especially with the gay and lesbian community, transgender community, with the African-American community, and of course, the Latino community. And we were able to, on two occasions, stop 187 in Oregon. We were able to do what California didn't do, you know, and we were able to stop that. Not only that, but we were in the time that we built this coalition, which his name is CAUSA, we have been able to stop, English-only legislation. We've been able to stop anti-affirmative action measures from happening. So we put together a really good coalition. And the coalition did some really effective organizing around that reintroduction of the Bracero program. One of the things that that agricultural interests in this country started doing about 5 years ago is they started introducing legislation that would bring in contract labor for Mexico and other countries. Basically what it is, it's NAFTA. What it is that, you know, you can't ship, farmland, to El Salvador or to Indonesia or to Mexico or the Dominican Republic. You do the next best thing. You bring the labor here, a cheap reserve army of labor, right? And what, they've introduced this at a time when, you know, there doesn't exist a shortage of farm workers. Documented farm workers or domestic farm workers in the country. On the contrary, the government accounting office, investigative arm of Congress, had just come out with a report that documented that there was double-digit unemployment among documented farm workers in every major community in the country. And so CAUSA, one of the things that we took the lead on that struggle nationally was because our two senators, a Democrat, Ron Wyden, and a Republican, Gordon Smith, who's also a grower, were the co-sponsors of that bill to reintroduce the Bracero program. So we fought tooth and nail. We had, I remember in about a month's time, we had 19 public actions against Ron Wyden, and eventually we got him off the bill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was a deal that was negotiated between the United Farm Workers Union and also the growers, right just before the election. And the deal would have granted amnesty to several million people. But it was, basically defeated by Phil Gramm and Trent Lott, the head of the leader of the Senate.
Well, this is an issue that's not going away, obviously. It's going to be around for some time. And one of the things that's so important is that when we talk about immigration reform, we can talk to people like yourself and people in your union to get a real sense of what some of these issues are. And you said earlier that you did have a contract with like three of the growers in Oregon. But one of the big ones, and one of the reasons you're here in Chicago, is that you have a particular problem with a cooperative, a grower cooperative. And you've been boycotting, organizing a boycott against this cooperative. Could you explain to us about this cooperative and why you feel such an important target for your organization?
Well, we've been boycotting since 1992. NORPAC. NORPAC is a 250 member cooperative of growers in the state of Oregon, and they package frozen fruit and vegetables under the label Flavor Pack, and also under Westpac, mm-hmm. And Saniam. And we're asking people in Chicago and Illinois to boycott those products because we feel that those 250 growers are treating their workers in an inhumane way. And that farm workers deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. And the boycott has been, we're going on our ninth year.
What are you asking NORPAC do? You mentioned it's 250 growers are part of this cooperative. What do you want them to do with you or to say to you?
Well, what we're asking NORPAC to do is sit down with the farm workers to negotiate. Our aim is to win collective bargaining agreements. Whatever it takes to win collective bargaining agreements, that's what we're fighting for. You know, we want to sit down and negotiate. You know, it's all based on negotiations. How we get there is a matter of discussion. What we do want is we want to have some sort of commission that would oversee union elections and a complaint process. We're not in favor of any collective bargaining bill at this time because we feel that it wouldn't be enforced by the state of Oregon. Oregon, for example, at this currently is facing an $800 million shortfall in its budget. And, you know, they're instead of, you know, adding more enforcement, for example, to enforce labor laws, they're cutting back. Mm-hmm. So to introduce a whole legal mechanism for collective bargaining wouldn't work. And we think a private solution is a lot better. But that's what the aim of this boycott is, to get NORPAC to negotiate with the farm workers to improve living and working conditions.
What are you asking our listeners to do?
Well, first and foremost, we'd like people of conscience to not buy NORPAC products, Westpac, NORPAC, Westpac, Flavor Pack products. That's first and foremost. Second, the way NORPAC is structured is NORPAC is they package, they distribute, they transport products, and they use brokers. And in Chicago, they're using a broker who then negotiates with institutions, with schools, with supermarkets to then, you know, sell the product. And so we think that that they play an important role at distributing NORPAC goods. And what we want to be able to do is send a message to those brokers and also to NORPAC that we will not stand companies that are not responsible. They're not responsible, you know, socially. And send a strong message, you know, to these people saying that they're, you know, NORPAC, you negotiate with the farm workers, right? You know, farm workers are not asking you for anything. We're only asking you what every American in this country enjoys already, you know, protections from retaliation, protections from violations of civil and human rights. And I think that's that, you know, we're in the year 2000 now, 2001, and farm workers, you know, the hardest working people in this country deserve, you know, to be treated with respect and dignity.
Also, you have a website, which is where I got a lot of the information I did before our interview, with www.pcunpcun.org. And you can get a lot of information about the union. When you go around, and you're going around in Chicago and some other cities, you're finding support from a lot of people. And you've also got some support from people up in Canada, which is where NORPAC also distributes some food. Could you talk about some of that support and how well you're doing with that?
Yeah. Well, this particular tour, was, was aimed at cities that there was food services in universities and colleges that had bon appetit. Bon appetit is a real upscale food service, and it's locally they're at the Loyola University. And we were asking Bon Appetit not to carry a flavor pack or NORPAC products. We had learned through students at various campuses in the throughout the country that Bon Appetit was carrying NORPAC. So we sent a letter to the CEO Baccio, and we also called them, and we got through to him, and he was able to he told us he didn't want to get involved in this struggle, and that. Therefore, he was going to take out NORPAC products from his food service, and he did. So we applaud him, and I'll be speaking at Loyola University, and you know, but yeah, the boycott is going really well. We're finding a lot of support. We're finding a lot of support here in Chicago. It's amazing. In Canada, for example, the Canadian Labor Congress, which is the equivalent of the AFL-CIO, has endorsed the boycott. We're a lot closer than we have been in the last 9 years of this boycott of winning it. You know, it's really going to take the public. Cesar Chavez, when he led the first great boycotts, there was a Nielsen poll done, and that poll revealed that 17 million people participated in that boycott. And that was a boycott that really led to the breaking of the chains that farm workers were shackled to for over 200 years. Right. And so we need to do that again with this boycott with NORPAC. Right. The farm workers in Oregon are making a call to all people of conscience, of all people who aspire, you know, and who work, you know, around civil and human rights issue, around issues of discrimination, to come to the aid of farm workers and really join us in spreading the word about this boycott.
Actually, when I first came to Chicago in the mid-1960s, one of the first things I did was got involved with the farm workers boycott here. And lots and lots and lots of people got involved and knew about the movement through those activities. And we hope that you'll do as well, and that we'll let people around Chicago and whoever else is interested know about what's going on. Again, let me give the website address, www.pcun.org. I'm talking with Ramon Ramirez, who is a founder and a president of PCUN, and he's on tour around the country to build up support for the NORPAC boycott, and we wish him much luck in his fight. Thank you very much, Ramon.
Thank you very much for having me. Si se puede.
Wayne Heimbach of Labor Express spoke with Ramon Ramirez last month in Chicago.
For my guns and my saddle.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Unwelcome.